The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The government is back open, at least temporarily. Markets rally on the news, but end the week flat, and the Fed is providing more dovish commentary. Our guest today is Dan Pila, an expert in IRS procedures and an advocate of taxpayer rights. All this and much more on episode number 597 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello. This is Andrew Horowitz, and I am the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And of course, the co-host of DH Unplugged, where John C. Dvorak and I get together each and every week on Tuesday night to be exact, 9 p.m., live and streaming with a chat room. If you haven't had the opportunity to visit that, check it out. I highly encourage you to do so. But here we are. It is now approaching the end of January and quite a turn of events from what we saw back just a month ago. I mean, almost a month ago, if you think about it, people were absolutely freaking out, right? We hit that low, that Christmas Eve low on December 24th. There was an incredible amount of action that was going on, and stocks were being sold off at it with just no thought. I mean, just sell, you know. And here we are, about a month later, when everybody's back in the groove of, hey, you know what? Maybe there's some great value in the markets and let's just buy. And that's good. We often see that. It's kind of this reflexive mirror action that we're seeing in the markets right now. Maybe it's technically driven. Maybe it's fundamentally. What I mean by that is maybe it's based on some chart patterns. Maybe it's based on some indicators like stochastics or RSI or a MACD. Somebody saw this on their chart and they're thinking, you know what? There's a good time that we're seeing a signal that historically has shown us that when it gets to these levels, that it becomes a reasonable entry point. And on the fundamental side, there are those that are looking at, well, you know, we had a PE ratio of this, and now we know fundamentally that the earnings look solid based on that. And when we calculate the value, it should be at this price that's well above where it is now. That gives me a buying opportunity. And then there's those that put it all together, like we do. We look at both technical and we look at the fundamental, and we look at the economic picture. And what's happening is that there is, at least at this point of time right now, there is a, I would say, an agreement that we have seen some of the lows that really took a lot of individual names to levels that were possibly unjustified, at least at the time that we are now. In other words, the price may be justified in the future, sometime in the future, if all these different things happen. However, right now, as we are here at this date, maybe it was unjustified. And therefore, there was some buying that went on. And I think that when you look at the current economic backdrop, and even if you spread it and look beyond our borders and look for things in even China, which is slowing down, its slowest rate of growth of their GDP since, I think, 2008. They are providing a massive amount of stimulus through whether it's loans or it's going to be in tax cuts or it's going to be reserve requirements that are going to be reduced for banks. They are very actively involved. And, you know, right now they need to be because they have a lot of things that are going against them, from a domestic consumption issue to the trade war and tariffs that are going on against them that seem to be never ending. At the same time, we're seeing that there's some concern about the backdrop and the underlying economic conditions in Europe. For example, just last week, we saw that the German confidence numbers for businesses hit like lows that we haven't seen in 10 years. At the same time, their markets are showing serious problems, or at least reasonable. Of course, they've all picked up, as they have all in unison around the world throughout 2019. But there is some underlying problems when you look particularly at the banks and you see that they're trading at, you know, historic levels on the downside. Not all of them, but major banks in Germany and throughout Europe are having really big problems. And I think it makes sense to start thinking about, well, what can Europe do? I mean, we have Brexit that's in front of us. We have historically low rates. They haven't even thought about increasing their rates at this point. So they don't really have a lot of, what would we call it? Gunpowder left? Dry powder left? Any kind of potential to really reduce rates any further unless they go, you know, hardcore into the negative environment again. And we saw that that really backfired on them. So here we are in the United States where we've seen a couple of years of rate increases. We've seen the Fed have done their job at trying to roll off some of their bonds, as we call it, quantitative tightening. And what happens when the Fed starts to say, hey, you know what, we're going to slow down potentially, or at least be somewhat data-centric or data-sensitive, more flexible. Markets react very strongly. Again, not the same thing that can happen over in Europe to the same degree. In fact, one of the other things that has been a big concern of a lot of people has been the idea that there has been a consistent tightening process and a liquidity drain on markets due to the fact that the Fed has been zapping liquidity through their bond program, whereas they're no longer reinvesting and buying bonds and letting about $50 billion of bonds roll off their balance sheet through this, quote, normalization process. This has been happening for some time. We still have a level of over, I think it's $4 trillion. But the Wall Street Journal on Friday reported that the Fed may be getting close to the end of their balance sheet normalization effort. In other words, this normalization went from $4.5 trillion, which was not normal, to $4 trillion, which now all of a sudden is normal. Or maybe what they're saying is, in a better way of looking at this, is that they're going to slow down on their roll-off process and the normalization process because they see some questionable items that are really starting to stick out in the economy, and they're concerned about that. I mean, it's not normal. It's not normal that we have a $4 trillion balance sheet of the Fed, the borrowing that they did through the quantitative easing program, and rates that are not historically low, but historically low on a relative basis, considering the unemployment rate, the economic growth that we have, all the things. If you put all that into perspective, we're at historically low rates. Maybe we'll think of it as a historically low real rates compared to our economic condition. I think that's a good way to look at it. And we talked a lot about this in our latest market commentary. Each quarter we write a market review and a little bit of an outlook, some of the things that we're doing for our clients. And I decided recently, as many of you have read and downloaded, that I'm going to offer these, at least for the time being, to anybody that wants to read these. And these are available over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com to either read or download. We just published it last week. We kind of put it out a week or so or 2 weeks after we send it out to clients, so they kind of get an advanced notice of what is going on here. But we talked in there about the latest moves by the Fed, and we had actually been expecting that they were going to look at slowing down on their overall, we'll call it their tightening programs. And that's fine to stop right there, but we went further in the last couple of commentaries and discussed what would be the impact if that happened. What, aside from the stock market, what else do we have to look at? So, for example, we had written, and I spoke about this many times, about the idea that the slowing economic conditions in the U.S. would force their hand and slowing their rate hikes and possibly ending or slowing down balance sheet reduction. And what I then did was focus on how can that really affect, for example, the U.S. dollar. We saw this great move and this great rally and then this major fall and then a rally again into last year that really sent the dollar high and hurt emerging markets and foreign markets and certain bonds. Well, if we believe that we're going to see, for one reason or another, either a reversal or a slowdown in the rally or a complete stop in the appreciation of the U.S. dollar, which we do believe, what areas are we going to focus on in our portfolios to properly allocate in a way that's consistent with that idea? With our view that there is going to be a slowing of the economic backdrop, possibly some concern over the ballooning deficit and debt that we have in the U.S., and maybe dependent on how this all plays out this tax season, what's going to happen with regard to tax receipts? And are we going to have a continuation of a ballooning deficit here in the U.S.? So we talked about some of the areas that could be most affected and what we did inside of our portfolios and outlined that in this report. So go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, read some of that. We talked about some of the change that we made and how we did it for our globally diversified portfolios. Also talked about, of course, for Investology. As we rebalance the portfolios with Investology, we also are going to implement these, our outlooks and our views on how market's going to play out, whether it's, you know, commodities or could it be stocks, U.S. domestic, foreign, emerging, large cap, small cap, all the things that go into an economic view and how that plays out on portfolio. So you can go to Investology as well, Investology.com. Investology. Click client logon when you go there and then create account if you haven't done so already, because you can start going through a series of questions that will then result in an output of a sample portfolio allocation. And from there, you can, of course, open an account that we manage. But you could see what our current allocations look like in terms of our portfolios. So it's a look at sectors and where we are. Now, of course, we then go and find individual areas that we invest in terms of funds or ETFs and institutional-based funds, et cetera. But it gives you an idea of what's happening. So a lot of you have asked about that. You know, what are we doing there and how do we manage it? So it's in there. It's on the site. It's also in there. In the quarter report, we also had an update on the trade war, a discussion of investment cycles that was kind of interesting in terms of sentiment of investors, and took a look back on asset allocation performance over the past few years. Now, one of the things we talk about, investor sentiment. Now, this is important because sentiment does drive markets. There's no question about that, right? We all know this, that you could have a really bullish sentiment out there and people are really excited about things. And what happens is that stocks will move up regardless, by the way, of their underlying fundamentals. Oftentimes, you'll just see stocks moving up to levels that maybe, quote, shouldn't be, but they move up. On the other hand, the opposite happens when sentiment deteriorates. So think about the idea of why markets move. Well, a big part of it is the idea of behavioral finance. And in fact, next week, our guest is expert Daniel Crosby on behavioral finance. We've had Daniel on before, and he's great. He's great. He just wrote a new book that I'm half to three quarters of the way through. I'll probably finish it by next week. And we're going to go through the whole idea of market psychology, investor psychology, things that I'm going to ask questions of, you know, what are people doing wrong that they spook themselves out of a trade, and how can they, you know, continue holding on to that trade without being so freaked out? How not to let the emotional aspects and the areas of psychology twist your view on what's actually happening. Daniel's the guy to talk to about that. Well, we'll talk about that. But one of the other things, let me just get back to this, in the report that we wrote, I thought was really interesting. This I thought was really pretty fascinating because we haven't seen this in some time. We saw that none of the major asset classes were positive in 2018. Now, we haven't seen that in some time. It's pretty unusual, in fact. In other words, you know, when you look at these major asset classes, we're not looking at things like the technology sector. That's not what we're looking at. We're looking at things like domestic U.S. stocks and foreign stocks and emerging stocks and a bond aggregate and the commodity aggregate. We're looking at these broad-based asset classes. And generally speaking, the ones that we track at least are all down last year. We haven't seen this in some time. And I was thinking about this. Well, what's that all about? Like, why would that happen? Why in a market where stocks were starting to sell off, didn't we see bonds possibly move higher as a safety trade? And what is that saying? So I really thought about this and I was thinking, you know, what is the common denominator? And of course, it's sentiment. That's a big part. But I think it was liquidity that really was the big problem last year. When you look at the fact that the Fed was draining liquidity from the system, I think that caused a lot of problems as soon as markets started to roll over. And that, of course, led to sentiment dropping as well. And that looped back again into causing more liquidity issues. And I think that excess volatility that we saw throughout the year, both at the beginning of the year and at the end of the year, was due to the fact that there is a tremendous amount of liquidity that is missing from this market right now. And that is obviously what the Fed has realized. Now, it's pretty sad to say that after a 10-year rally, a 10-year economic expansion, a massive amount of, we'll call it recapture of the growth and the underlying values of securities and houses and markets and portfolios and 401ks and you name it, that we're still having a liquidity problem. What does that mean? I think part of it, not to harp on this issue over and over again, but part of it is due to the fact that when you look at stocks, so many shares have been retired over the years through share buybacks that it creates less shares on the open market, therefore allowing prices to move up and higher with less pressure and down with less pressure. So in addition to the Fed draining liquidity from the system, companies have drained a significant amount of liquidity from the system. So think about that and think about how the next time we see this, and then of course add to the fact that we have a lot of money in ETFs as a broad-based asset. Therefore, if you want in the market or out of the market, you push a button, you get in, you get out. Therefore, that means that when emotions are running hot, people can move very quickly in and out of things, taking down entire tranches of positions. Let's get to some of the things that are happening this week coming up and look back at last week. I will say that next week, if the government being open does not delay, or the shutdown that we had does not delay some of the reports that are supposed to come out, we have a pretty big week of economic news that's going to be coming out. In particular, we have, of course, the employment report that will be coming out. Now, the last few initial claims, I've been scratching my head on this. We saw a sub 200 number. I don't know if that's because the unemployment offices were closed, maybe, or closing, or reporting is off. But I would have expected to see a lot more unemployment claims, at least temporarily, because of the government shutdown. So we'll have to see how that plays out over the next few weeks, because something's a little strange there. We also are going to see, yes, the employment report at the end of the week. We're at pretty low sub 4% unemployment rate, which is great. And we'll see if there's going to be a significant amount of additions like we saw last month. Of course, we saw a very hot number in terms of employment, which you would expect not to be the case again because of some of this sentiment changes that happened at the end of the year. Last week, we also saw some interesting action. I thought this was really pretty fascinating. Everybody thought that the semiconductor sector was pretty much left for dead. And, you know, we saw that many of the technology companies that were associated with smartphones, particularly Apple and Samsung, after their numbers and the reports that smartphone sales are slowing and desktops are slowing and iPads are slowing and laptops are slowing and all. You say, oh, you know, what's going to go on with these semiconductor companies that provide many of the chips for this? Well, aside from Intel, which I expected actually that not to come in as a good report, they got it down pretty significantly. They have a big footprint in the areas that probably would be affected the most by some of the smartphone slowdown. But interestingly, it was one of the best week in one of the best days. There was a couple of days there that was the best day for semiconductor index in, I think, 10 years. We saw Xilinx, symbol XLNX, hit an all-time high. Now, I'm happy about that because we hold that as a core holding for client accounts inside of the managed growth strategy, the TDI managed growth strategy. We also saw Dow Components, IBM actually do pretty well. Procter Gamble, United Technologies provided strong reports overall, and their stock prices were up nicely. Johnson & Johnson, Travelers, underwhelmed a bit. Next week, though, we're going to be seeing Caterpillar. That's going to be early part of the week. That will be a really good read on this whole global condition. I think Caterpillar is one of those bellwethers that you have to really pay attention to. So we're going to watch that very closely to see not only what they've done, but their outlook, and specifically related to China, of course. And then we're going to have a lot of big names throughout the week, inclusive of Amazon, Microsoft, Facebook. So I think Microsoft next week. But I know there's going to be some big technology names and hundreds of earnings that are going to be coming out next week. So why don't we, at this point, get to our guest. I wanted to have something a little bit different this particular episode. We always talk markets and behavior or psychology and technicals and individual names. And every once in a while, I try to weave in a more practical discussion that's going to be related to things like, who knows what it could be. But this time, we're going to talk about something that I think is very important and very timely, which is the idea of tax audits. This is an expert on the area, and I have so many questions to ask. So let's get right to that discussion. And our guest today is Dan Pilla from TaxHelpOnline.com. He's an expert in IRS procedure and an advocate of taxpayer rights. He's an author of How to Win Your Tax Audit. As a matter of fact, Dan, you've authored 15 books on the subject. You have over 1,000 articles on the subject. And first of all, hello. But second of all, how is there so much information available for 15 books on this subject?
Well, I'll tell you, Andrew, first of all, hello to you and thanks for having me. I appreciate that. But, you know, we've got an Internal Revenue Code, Andrew, that consists of about 4 million words. And that code has been changed more than 5,900 times just since 2001 alone. And that doesn't even include the 70 or 80 changes that were brought about by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So, you know, how is there so much information? Well, it's constantly in flux for one thing. For another thing, there are so many aspects of the Internal Revenue Code that people need to know about. Audits is just one of them. But that's how we've got such a mountain of information to help people that are going through problems with the IRS, whether it's an audit, appeal, or a collection problem.
So I guess the question, though, is with all of this information back from the last 15 or so years plus and what we've seen recently with the tax, we'll call it, here's the question. Did we recently get any kind of tax change in terms of simplification or any kind of a tax program that was instituted, or is it just tax cuts?
Well, no, I wouldn't call it simplification. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, I don't believe is tax simplification, not in the truest sense of the word, Andrew, how I would simplify the tax code. And you know, what they did is they eliminated certain deductions and they put caps on certain other things. The fact is that the tax cuts is a tax cut, no doubt about that. The Act, the Jobs Act, let me put it that way for clarity. The Jobs Act is a tax cut. There's no question about that. About 80% of all tax return filers in America are going to see a reduction to their tax liability. So it's just undeniably a tax cut. And those 80%, by the way, are the bottom 80%, not the top 80%. So these allegations that it's just a tax cut for the rich is nonsense. It's, the middle class are going to see the bulk of the relief under the Jobs Act. But it's not simplification, Andrew. They just stirred the pot. Certain things are deductible that weren't. Certain other things that were deductible are not. There's certain provisions for businesses that will reduce tax liability and so forth. But these are complex provisions, and it's going to take time to work through to figure out how all these things work.
I guess I could say then congratulations to you, because you'd probably have another book to write on the subject. Seriously.
Well, in fact, seriously now, this is no kidding. I just published a report that's 11,000 words, Andrew, on just one tax code provision in the Jobs Act. Right. It's code section 199A. It is the deduction for small businesses that gives them a 20% deduction. It's a tremendously important tax break, but it's monstrously complicated. And so I published a report on that to help small businesses navigate the morass that is that 199A deduction.
And the problem is that the certain players in the industry, like financial services and accountants, that are pretty much not going to be able to take advantage of that, right?
Well, yeah, there's some people that are, and there are limitations. Personal services companies are limited, but I will tell you this, Andrew, the deduction is available for any taxpayer whose taxable income without respect to the deduction is under $157,500 for single taxpayers and under $215,000 for married filing jointly. So anybody that falls into that range, regardless of the nature of their business, is going to get that deduction.
Mm. Let me back up for a second because I want to ask you something. So You're from what I know, you're an expert in the area of IRS procedures and an advocate of taxpayer rights, right?
That's correct. Yes. That is absolutely correct.
What does that – now, I understand you're an expert in the IRS procedure. What is an advocate of taxpayer rights with the sub-question of what rights do taxpayers actually have when you're put against the IRS?
Okay, well, that's a good question, and let me start with the first answer. What it means is that I don't prepare tax returns for a living, all right? As a tax litigation specialist and somebody who's dealing with IRS issues, IRS problems, I don't prepare tax returns for a living. My office does certain tax return preparation, but mostly it's remedial, all right? So we step into the act. We get involved when somebody is having some kind of a specific problem with the IRS. Maybe they're under audit. Maybe they're in an appeals process. About 70 or 75% of the work that I do is collection defense, where somebody owes the IRS $50 or $100 or $200,000 and they can't pay, and the IRS is executing wage levies and bank levies and tax liens and so on. That's where I get in to help those people solve the problem. Now, what was the second part of your question, Andrew?
It was about the rights of taxpayers.
The rights of taxpayers, of course. What rights do taxpayers have? Well, I'll tell you what. The National Taxpayer Advocate did a survey, Andrew, and she asked a representative sample of taxpayers two questions. Number one, do you realize that you have rights as a taxpayer? And number two, do you know anything about those rights? Well, about 60% of the people who answered said that they didn't believe they had any rights at all.
Right,
and
right.
all right. And of the remaining folks, fewer than 25% of those could identify any single right that they knew they had to begin with. So the answer to your question is people don't think they have any rights when they're dealing with the IRS, but that is absolutely not true.
Well, that's the way, from what I understand, when they come at you with an audit, it's kind of like, okay, back it up, give us this information, and if you don't, we're pretty much going to take everything away from you.
And that's what people think. And the IRS wants people to think that. But here's the thing that you need to understand, and I talk about this in my book, How to Win Your Tax Audit. This is one of the most important rights that people have when they're dealing with the IRS, and that is this. The decision of a tax auditor is never final. It is never final. Tax auditors don't have the power, Andrew, to force you to agree to give up certain of your deductions. Tax auditors don't have the power to put you in jail. They don't have the power to seize your property. They can't even change your tax return without your consent. All the tax auditor does is evaluate your return and your information and then makes a recommendation. Now, the recommendation, literally 89% of the time, is that you owe more money because they disallow this deduction, or at least they propose to disallow this deduction or that deduction. But if you don't sign the agreement, you don't owe the money. You have an absolute right to challenge that agreement. You've got 30 days from the proposal. You've got 30 days from the date of the proposal to file a simple appeal letter. The book shows you how to do it. When you appeal your case, statistically, you're going to win your case. The IRS's Office of Appeals, their literature indicates that the IRS's audit results are wrong between 60 to 90% of the time, depending on what issue you're talking about. And so you're going to have a better than a 50-50 chance of winning some or all of your arguments at the appeals level, and that's a critical right that you have. And as long as that case is on appeal, the IRS can't touch one nickel's worth of your assets, because as long as the case is on appeal, you don't owe them anything.
Hmm. You know, it is interesting because, like I said, a lot of people think that, you know, you could just basically, you know, when the IRS does come in, first of all, it's I know people have had audits. You do, obviously. It's sure. It's not pleasurable.
No, it's not.
It's not pleasurable, no. Even if your I's are dotted and your T's are crossed.
Well, and it's not pleasurable primarily because the IRS uses bluff and intimidation, misinformation and disinformation, and in many cases they just lie to people concerning what their rights are and what their obligations are. And this is the thing that I want people to understand. This is what is so critical. When you are called in for a tax audit, it doesn't mean that you made a mistake in your tax return. This is what people automatically think. I did something wrong. I've been caught. What's this going to cost me? That puts them on the defensive, and it makes them willing to, or at least emotionally prepared to write a check, even though, you know, most people can't afford to pay the tax the IRS says you owe when you're done with an audit. But here's the thing you need to understand. That tax return is selected not because you made a mistake, but because there's something in the return that seems out of whack. All right. And so the IRS assigns that return for an examination to determine whether it's correct. And so this is the process that an audit involves, going in there to ascertain whether the tax return is correct. So let's understand that. The second thing you need to understand, and this is critical, is that the burden of proof is on the taxpayer. The IRS never has to prove you made a mistake. You have to prove you did it right. And this is where people fall short. They don't go into the audit prepared to prove that their tax return is correct. So I show you exactly step by step how to do that. So when you're dealing with this auditor, you're presenting the information correctly and you're presenting the proper information correctly to come out with your money in your pocket where it belongs.
So let's go back here because I'm kind of going a little bit, I'm doing the reverse process here, but this particular issue with regard to the IRS auditing and then saying, okay, you owe this, and then it could be something that you have to prove. And the idea that you have that right to go in and challenge what they say. So there's two things. Well, first, I want to back all the way up into how you got into this business because there's a story here. There's a story about your personal knowledge and experience dealing with an audit that really got you interested in this, right?
Yeah, and it really wasn't an audit, Andrew, that got me into it. It was a very serious collection problem. My father had a small business here in St. Paul, Minnesota, our hometown. He got behind on his employees withholding taxes. This was early 1970s. In 1974, the IRS padlocked the doors on his business, and they auctioned the equipment off for a couple cents on the dollar. This was an employment tax liability, so he got into financial problems, got behind on the employment tax liability, ended up getting shut down. Then several years later, 1978, the IRS turned their attention to our family home, and they tried to seize and sell it for the back tax liability, and that's when I got involved. I was about 18 years old. I came home one day, and my mom was sitting at the table with this letter from the IRS in her hand, And she hands this thing to me, and she says, "What do you make of this?" And I read it, and I said, "Well, it looks like they're going to try to seize the house." And she says, "Well, what do we do about it?" Well, I had no idea what to do. But what I did do is I went over to the local law library. I started fumbling around in the Internal Revenue Code. And, Andrew, I didn't even know what I was looking for. I'm just fumbling around in the tax code. And I literally stumbled on to an area of the tax code that deals with taxpayers' rights and limits the power of the IRS. And I start reading in this section. I didn't get six pages into it, and discovered that the IRS was proceeding illegally to seize our home. So I did what any 18-year-old would do under the circumstances. I sued the IRS.
Yeah, that's natural.
Yeah, that's natural. Yeah. I filed this lawsuit, and before too long, I found myself in a federal courtroom in Minneapolis in front of a federal judge. The IRS had flown an attorney in from Washington, D.C., from the Justice Department, the Tax Division in Washington, D.C., and he comes in to have my case thrown out of court. And I stand up in front of the judge and say, "Judge, you know, the IRS is trying to take this property, but the law says this, and they're trying to do something different, and, you know, they shouldn't be allowed to get away with that." And I sat down, and that was about as polished as the argument was. I didn't say much more than that. And this Justice Department attorney stood up, and he started blathering things about court cases this and statutes that, and I had no idea what this guy was talking about. But when he was done, the lawyer sat down, the judge looked at him, and pointed at me and said, "He's right." And he slammed the gavel. And I thought, well, this is easy. And so that was it. I started out from there. I started out from there, and it was more or less an instant practice, because here's the fascinating part of the story. In between the time my dad got in trouble with the IRS and the time that I was in that courtroom in Minneapolis, by now that was about 1979, my dad got involved in the tax protester movement. And these are the people that say tax laws are illegal and voluntary and unconstitutional and all the rest of this stuff. I'm sure you've heard all that nonsense. Uh-huh. Well, he got involved with this, you know, more as a matter of desperation than anything else, which is usually how people get involved in these arguments to begin with. Well, my dad's tax protester buddies were in that courtroom that day watching the proceeding.
Oh.
And there was upwards of 100 people in there, and most of them were these my dad's tax protester buddies. So by the time I got home to my house, they were lined up at the door. And they said, Can you help me with my tax problem?
Can you help me?
I said, sure, baby, I'm undefeated. Let's go here.
And that's right.
And that was it. That was the here's what happened. Here's what I learned in that case that I applied to every single one of those cases and still apply today in my practice. I asked two simple questions. Number one, what is the IRS doing in this case? And number two, what does the law allow them to do?
Yeah,
and I find, Andrew, that in half the cases, the IRS is cheating blind, not following their own rules.
I mean, we know that the government needs money, and that's another question. You know, with the current tax code as it is, with the ballooning deficits, with the debt outstanding in the $4 trillion level, give or take, on the books with the Fed and also the debt that we have here in the United States, is there the potential, do you think, for additional money grabs to be going on if the IRS ever opens back up again after the government shutdown in order to try to fill the coffers a little bit?
Okay, well, I hate to break your heart, Andrew, but the IRS is going to open up again. There's just
yeah,
no question.
I got that.
if the federal government funds anything, they're going to fund the IRS. There's just no question about that. But as far as money grabs, listen, money grabs have been going on as long as I've been in this business, and they're going to continue to go on. And this is one reason that people always ask me, why is the tax code so complicated? Couldn't it be simple? The answer is, of course, it could be simple. And in fact, a simple tax code would raise more money than a complicated code does. But Congress doesn't want it simple. The IRS doesn't want it simple, because as long as it's complicated, Andrew, you never know for sure whether you did it right or not. And so consequently, you're always an easy target for an audit where the IRS comes in and just basically literally steals your money, because they cheat blind in the audit process because people don't know the difference.
So one of the things you said earlier was that when it comes to an audit, something maybe seems out of the ordinary on a tax return, sticks out a little bit. I think in the language and lingo of the accounting industry, you'd hear it called as a flag, right? A flag.
Yeah, exactly. Yep, a red flag, sure.
So what are these items that come up most frequently with regard to these red flags?
Well, first of all, it can be any number of things because let me tell you how it works, all right? The IRS has a very complicated, or sophisticated, I should say, computer program called the Discriminant Income Function System. And what that program does is it compares every line of your tax return with national and regional statistical averages for a person in your same income category and profession. If any one line of your return is out of sync with those averages, the difference is scored. The higher the score, it's called a diff score. The higher the score, the more likely you are to be audited, because the higher the score, the farther away you are from the averages. And so again, it doesn't mean you did something wrong. It just means that you're out of whack based on those averages. 2/3 of all tax returns selected for audit are selected on the basis of these diff scores. So it could be anything. It could be absolutely anything on the return. Now, that said, the IRS also conducts what they call compliance initiatives. Another 20% or so of the returns selected for audit are selected on the basis of compliance initiatives. A compliance initiative is a specific enforcement program based on a particular set of facts. I'll give you an example. The IRS will routinely look at small business tax returns that show a loss on the return. And the IRS will flag those for audit, claiming that it's not a legitimate business. It's really just a hobby. You don't get to write off your expenses from a hobby. If this was a real business, you'd be making money. That's a compliance initiative. So if you've got a small business and you're losing money, then you're a target for an audit. If you're claiming a home office on your tax return, that's another compliance initiative the IRS has used for years, looking at the home office deduction to see if it's legitimate. Another compliance initiative is the use of independent contractors. More and more small businesses are using independent contractors in their business, not employees, because of the cost of employees. And so this misuse of independent contractors is a compliance initiative. And there's a laundry list of them. And I talk about them in the book, How to Win Your Tax Audit and How to Deal with That Stuff.
It's interesting because, like you said, there are so many things. What we have to do is convince everybody in the country in your particular your particular income level and your particular industry to do their tax returns exactly the same, so we're all on average.
Well, of course, even if that were possible, why would you do that? Because, and here's the thing, and people ask me this all the time. They'll say, why don't we just get the DIF scores, and why don't I just pattern my deductions after the DIF scores so I don't stand out? Well, the answer is twofold. First of all, the IRS won't give you the DIF scores. All right, you're going to get the plans to the Titan submarine faster than you get it to get the DIF scores from the IRS. They won't release them. So that's number one. Number two is, why would you not claim a deduction on your tax return that you're perfectly legally entitled to just because you're afraid of an audit? See, what you're going to learn from the book, How to Win Your Tax Audit, is that you don't have to be afraid of an audit. You can claim every deduction you're legally entitled to claim, reduce your tax liability to its lowest legal level, but do it without risk because you know how to prove that the return is correct.
So what is the, when people are preparing, whether they're working with an accountant or doing it on their own for that matter, and what do most people do wrong when they're submitting or filling out or completing their tax return?
Well, statistically speaking, people don't have the proper records they need to support their deductions. When we're talking about small businesses, about two-thirds of every disallowed deduction that the IRS imposes on a small business is because of lack of records. Now, there's a lot of reasons for that, and as I said, the IRS is wrong in a lot of cases, and that's true too. But let's just focus on this lack of records for just 1 second. People don't understand what their burden of proof is, Andrew. They don't understand two things. One, that they have the burden of proof, and two, how to carry that burden of proof. So they very rarely have the records they need to support the accuracy of the items on their return. So if a person is filling out a return for themselves, and they're just, basically throwing a dart at the dartboard to see what number they're going to put in this category or that category, or it's not that brazen, but rather it's, I probably had 10,000 miles last year for my car, and I probably spent, at least $3,000 on advertising, and they start plugging these numbers in based on what they think happened, that's where people get into trouble. You've got to base it on the information that you have. You've got to have the records to support the information you put in the return.
So one of the things that I do, and tell me what you think about this, is that for many business expenses, obviously, aside from canceled checks for a particular expense, you pay something so you have a canceled check. I use a credit card like a designated credit card for business expenses. And this way I have at least all of the transactions that I can pull from the various credit card company, that credit card company, and have it itemized. Is that a smart thing to do?
It is a smart thing to do, and that gives you the numbers, and it gives you the business that you spent the money, the payee information. That's all clear. But here's the other thing that you got to do. You got to establish that each and every expense was for the purposes of earning income, that the expense was incurred for the purposes of building and operating your business. And so the payee information on the credit card statement might not necessarily prove that. For example, if you go to the grocery store and you buy a bunch of dry goods at the grocery store that you need for your business. Maybe you bought some ink pens, maybe you bought some notepads, maybe you bought some whatever, fill in the blank, right? But you bought it at the local grocery store. So your credit card shows that you spent money at the grocery store. It shows the date and it shows the amount. Okay, fine. But the credit card doesn't prove that that expenditure was for business. So you still have to fill in that blank.
Right. But if you do itemize it and say it was for supplies, will they want you to go back even further and, let's say, have a receipt? Let's say it's $32 worth of supplies.
They may want you to produce a receipt to show that you didn't buy a turkey for your Thanksgiving dinner.
Right. And that's where the problems come in.
And that's where the problems come in.
Not necessarily, by the way, that it would be disallowed, but the effort to try to get that receipt is monumental.
Well, and it depends on are you keeping the receipts or aren't you? Because whenever you have a transaction, you're going to get a receipt. You know, every time you go to a store, the cashier, and you use a credit card or a debit card,
right,
the cashier says, would you like a receipt? Well, instead of saying no, say yes. Put it in your file.
Just stick it in the file. It can't hurt having more. Can't hurt having more.
No, absolutely.
And there are some great programs that you can snap the picture of the receipt with.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Exactly right. Yes, exactly right. And I encourage people to do that. Now, you say it can't hurt to have more. Here's what I tell my clients, all right? And this is important. The burden of proof is on you, and you can't overprove your case.
Can't
overprove. So more is always better.
Right. However, don't give them more than they're asking for.
Yeah, that's very true. Yes.
Right?
No, and that's a good point because people tend to talk too much. And I make this point in the book as well. You got to focus on what they're asking you and don't offer up information that they're not asking for.
Right. If they're asking for a particular line item and say they're discussing this, don't start talking about, oh, when we had this vacation last year that we also wrote off and it was related
exactly right
to, and then
exactly
get yourself into
right
a big
yep
hole.
Precise.
And by the way, they probably come across very nice in the discussions and meetings, but, you know.
Oh, very often they do, no doubt about it. Yep.
Yep. Yep. So one of the articles you recently wrote was about this concept of big data and the IRS. You talked about this whole partnership with Palantir and the IRS granting Palantir information about X number of millions of tax returns and information. And I have a couple of points on this. So first of all, what are they looking to do here? And what's the problem?
Well, here's what they're looking to do. The IRS is sitting on literally a mountain of data. Just let me throw out a couple numbers. Every year, this year, the IRS is going to collect about 152 million individual tax returns. They're going to collect another 100 million business tax returns. They're going to collect another a handful million or so of miscellaneous returns, estates, trusts, that sort of thing. And they're going to collect 3.8 billion information returns. I'm talking about W-2s, 1099s, those kinds of things. Now, that's just the information that's flown into the IRS through the tax laws that require reporting. In addition to that, the IRS is getting bank records through currency transaction reports and suspicious activity reports and so on. There's all kinds of data that's flown into the IRS. All right, they're literally sitting on billions and billions, probably trillions of bits of information. What do they do with that? How do they assimilate it? What they've contracted for is a massive computer system that will create a software program that will allow the IRS to search, analyze, visualize, and interact with this wide and disparate data set. So users will be able to leverage that information, and they'll be able to use it in analytics. They'll be used to link from particular data points to other data points. They'll be able to detect patterns. They'll be able to create statistical analyses. They'll be able to establish behavior patterns in all of the taxpayers whose data this represents. And so what they're looking for is the capacity to assimilate the data and to create and visualize patterns that that data reflects, and then to use that data in the audit and collection process.
Ugh. That sounds
horrifying. It goes beyond just the tax return information. We're talking about social media information. We're talking about credit card and debit card transactions. We're talking about bank deposits and bank statement information. We're talking about cell phone records. I mean, so for example, if you post on your social media site that you had this wonderful vacation and you and the family went to Florida for 3 weeks, well, in your case, probably not Florida. That's where you're at.
Yeah.
But you guys take a vacation to California, for example, and you spend these 3 wonderful weeks in California. You've got all your social media pictures up there about what a great time you had. And the IRS looks at this and says, well, gee, wait a minute. This guy takes a 3-week vacation to California. He's got 3 weeks off of work. He's got all this money that he spent. And oh, by the way, we know that he took 10 grand out of his bank, 10 grand cash out of his bank to do that, because we got the currency transaction reports from the bank. And here we look at his tax return and we see that he's only claiming, you know, let's just say $50,000 worth of income. How can he possibly afford a vacation like that on $50,000 worth of income? He must be hiding income somewhere. We better start digging into this.
Is it? There's no privacy. Well, I mean, you talk about cell phone records, or you talk. I mean, they're allowed to grab all that. And I also thought that that IRS, your IRS tax returns were private, only to be seen by you or whoever you authorize, and the IRS. How are they then granting access to this other company to work with this? Because they're going to require the other company to have people on the on the systems.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And they've been disclosing information to this company to do exactly that. And there's the privacy the privacy statute in the Internal Revenue Code, Section 6103, is basically a farce, because what it does is it allows the IRS to give your tax information to everybody on the planet, basically, except your wife. You know, it's unbelievable the latitude that this statute gives the IRS to disclose. They can, first of all, you know, just at the simplest level, they can disclose that tax return information to any other government agency, Andrew, federal, state, local, even international, that claims an interest in your information. And that's right in the statute. I mean, the bottom line is you have no financial. Anybody who thinks they got financial privacy in the United States is dreaming. There is no financial privacy.
And this runs right into and smacks right into, it doesn't run, it smacks right into the whole concern about, you know, what are you sharing on your social media, and don't be stupid about it.
Right, right. Yeah, but that ship has sailed, man.
Yeah,
that
well,
ship has long since sailed.
It's sailed and it's cruising at full speed, it's unfortunate. Because
yes, it
the
is.
Other problem is, even if you delete things, there are things that are saved.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
That's a problem.
And, you know, the IRS has got the experts, or they have at least hired the experts to mine that stuff. And that's precisely what they're doing, is mining it.
Yeah. So now step into back to the audit discussion. When somebody receives an audit letter request, you know, whatever comes through the mail, whatever comes through the process, give me your best tip of what to do first.
Well, let me tell you what not to do first. Don't panic. The reason I said before, it doesn't mean that you made a mistake, so don't panic. Number two, it would be the action item, and that is go through that letter very carefully. Make sure you absolutely understand what it is the IRS is asking for. And if the IRS doesn't ask for anything, if they just say you've been selected for audit, show up at our office next Tuesday, don't do it. Respond to the auditor and say, I want to know specifically what is in question here so I can bring the proper records. Pin the IRS down as to what is at issue. Normally, the letter will explain, we're going to look at this deduction and that deduction. So from there, you're going to gather the information you need to support that deduction. You're going to compare that information with what you claimed on your tax return and make sure that the two match. And if they don't match, for some reason there's an overstatement on the deduction compared to what your records are, again, don't panic. Go back and see if you can reconstruct the information, the missing records, to support the deduction. You've got the absolute right to reconstruct lost records or missing records, so reconstruct them to support the deduction, and then provide that information to the IRS along with a detailed letter of explanation so mm-hmm. that you are providing to them what they need to know to support the correctness of your return.
Good stuff. Dan Pilla from TaxHelpOnline.com. You can grab his books over at Amazon, one of the 15 that he has. Read his articles, find out more information, because, you know, I'm sure there's some people out there that are listening that have had this circumstance or will have it. And at least, you know now not to panic, and some of the steps, some of the things that you can do to mitigate some of the items that are here, what to do to make sure that you are better off than those that are not paying attention, and making sure that your financial future is set without a major train wreck if this you know, happens. What is the statistic about how many people are audited? You know, what is your chance of audit?
Well, it depends on what kind of audit we're talking about. If you're talking about a face-to-face audit, Andrew, the number's about between 2 to 3%. It fluctuates north and south every year. But the IRS audits virtually every single tax return through the electronic process.
Mm-hmm.
And the vast majority of audits are done through the mail, not face-to-face.
Right. Good stuff.
And you know, we're talking about millions of them every year.
Yeah. Well, we'll have more information about Dan on the show notes for episode number 597 over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Dan, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, now you have it. What to do and what not to do if fingers crossed, hopefully not. Man, if the audit happens. Anyway, good information there from Dan. I appreciate that. Go check out his book. Go check out all the things he has to say, his various articles, etc. We have all the information on how to get in touch with him over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, episode number 597. You can just check out the show notes right there. And we'll be back, like I said, next week with Daniel Crosby and talking about behavioral finance, investor psychology. And I really encourage you not only to listen, but tell your friends about that, because it's going to be a really great episode. I'm sure of it, because Daniel and I have talked before and it's always been really enlightening, and it provides just a little bit more insight into how we think as investors and what to do to combat some of our worst habits we have that are really related to our emotions. So make sure to listen to that. Otherwise, I will see you again next week. Thank you so much for joining me. Make sure to tune into DH Unplugged. We'll talk soon. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.